Welcome, my name is Divine. This is episode 487 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'm going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK Step 3 exams. This is going to be series 104. Let's get right into it. So, what if they give you a question about a 25-year-old male and they tell you that he's 6 foot 5 inches tall and that for the past 2 hours he has had very significant chest pain, and then they tell you that his blood pressure is 115 over 80, his heart rate is 85 beats per minute, and his respiratory rate is 19 breaths per minute, and you are asked for the next best step in diagnosis? Well, I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, sounds like we're going to get a chest CT angiogram with contrast, right? This person clearly has an aortic dissection. You may wonder, Divine, how do you know this person has an aortic dissection? Well, pretty straightforward. Number one, the person is 6 foot 5 inches tall. The USMLE is, they're not just going to give heights of people for no great reason. It's kind of ridiculous, right? They're pretty much telling the person has Marfan syndrome. So the person likely has Marfan syndrome, and Marfans, remember, they can have a cystic medial necrosis, which we call cystic medial degeneration of the aortic media, and because of that they can have dissection. And if you look at the vitals that I give you, because this person is totally fine from a vitals perspective, you know, they have the chest pain, but they don't seem to be doing really poorly, then it makes sense to do a CT chest angiogram with contrast. That's how you diagnose aortic dissection when a person is stable. But if a person has aortic dissection and they're hemodynamically unstable, they're going to do a TEE, going to do a transesophageal echocardiogram, going to do a transesophageal echocardiogram. Now, some of you may say, Divine, is there something else that could be the right answer in this question? Absolutely. Something else that could be the right answer in this question is the person having some kind of pneumothorax. But the thing is, if they want you to think pneumothorax, they will give you something along the lines of decreased breath sounds somewhere. They will give you something about maybe the person having, like, you know, jugular venous distension or whatever, right? Or, you know, just something that goes along the lines of, wait, this person is not doing particularly well. So that's one thing they can easily test on your exams, right? But, you know, if they're giving you a Marfan patient on chest pain, they're probably going after aortic dissection. That's probably the first thing I think about if I were you. And again, real quick, what are the key details to know about Marfan syndrome? Remember, first things first, it's an autosomal dominant disorder, right? So if, since it's an autosomal dominant disorder, most people that are born with it, they have one of the bad genes, right? Usually for autosomal dominant disorders, when you have two bad genes, you're usually not going to be born alive. Those things are usually like perinatal lethal. But when you have, most people that are born are going to have one copy of the bad gene. So basically, if you see a Marfan disease patient on your exam, assume that their genotype is big A, little A. And obviously, if they marry someone that does not have Marfans, so the person is probably like little a, how many of their children, or what percent of their children are gonna have a problems? Well, I would really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, like 50% of their kids are gonna have problems. Well, how did I do that math? Well, big A, little a, multiplied by little a, if you work it out, you have big A, little a, you have big A, little a, you have little a, and you have little a, right? So basically, like 50% of your children will be completely normal and 50% are going to have Marfans, right? I remember Marfans, the problem is with it's a fibrillin defect. Fibrillin is like an extracellular protein. Basically, if it's messed up, then your aortic media is not going to hold up very well on your test, honestly, and then you're going to end up getting a lot of trouble. So they can have things like aortic dissection, they can get mitral valve prolapse. And remember, they can also get like aneurysms in the circle of Willis. That will be more like a headache presentation. It'll be an acute headache. It'll be an acute headache presentation in those folks, right? So something you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind as you're studying for your exams. And I remember people that have Marfans, they probably shouldn't be doing contact sports. Kind of seems like a wonderful way to rupture the aorta. So those people, contact sports are not a good idea for those people. And honestly, that's something I'm sure is pretty high yield to know for your exams. So again, chromosome 15, fibrillin defect, autosomal dominant inheritance. They will have mitral valve prolapse, aneurysms in the circle of Willis that can pop, rupture, cause the brain bleeds. They can give aortic dissection. And again, I've kind of worked out the genetics of it. If they marry someone that does not have Marfans, basically they're gonna have 50% of their kids are gonna have Marfans, and 50% will be completely normal. Okay, remember, when you're dealing with an autosomal dominant disease, carriers is not really a big thing. If you have the bad gene, you're going to get in trouble. Simple and straightforward as that. Okay, now, another thing I want to kind of go over here are the different kinds of hemoglobins. I feel like many people kind of botch these hemoglobins, and they just pop up often enough on the exam. You kind of want to know what they represent. So what's the first hemoglobin I'm going to discuss? Well, I'm going to discuss regular adult hemoglobin. Regular adult hemoglobin has two alpha genes and two beta genes. That's literally how it works, right? It's normal adult hemoglobin is two alpha genes, two beta genes. Now, what if they give you that, a person has anemia, and you notice that in the midst of that anemia, they have an elevation in their hemoglobin A2. If you see a person that has a hemoglobin A2 elevation, you easily want to think of a person that has beta thalassemia on your test. You may be like, Divine, what in the world is hemoglobin A2? Well, let me explain. Hemoglobin A2 is alpha 2, delta 2. Alpha 2, delta 2. The thing is, if you have beta thalassemia where your beta globin gene is all messed up, then you're not going to have enough to make regular adult hemoglobin, which is hemoglobin A. You won't have enough to make alpha 2, beta 2. So your body's going to be like, okay, well, what's the next best thing? Let's find these deltas and pair up with our alphas. So you have alpha 2, delta 2. That's going to be hemoglobin A2. In fact, let me tell you this right now. If you have an increase in hemoglobin A2, I'm going to say that again. If you have an increase in hemoglobin A2, that's almost pathognomonic on the USMLE exams for a person that has beta thalassemia. Now, okay, how about hemoglobin F? Hemoglobin F, right, is the one that we find in the fetus. That's alpha 2, gamma 2. Alpha 2, gamma 2. Alpha 2, gamma 2. That's hemoglobin F. I remember regular adult hemoglobin of alpha, which is hemoglobin A, alpha 2, beta 2. We don't really use it much until we kind of come out of the womb, until you pop out of the womb. But hemoglobin F, alpha 2, gamma 2, remember, that's the one we use in utero. That's pretty high yield to know. And also, it's pretty high yield to know that the drug that can increase your hemoglobin F is going to be hydroxyurea. Hydroxyurea is a drug that we use to treat sickle cell disease. Believe it or not, hydroxyurea is an anti-cancer drug. It works by inhibiting the enzyme ribonucleotide reductase, which converts ribonucleic acid to deoxyribonucleic acids, but it raises hemoglobin F. The mechanism, I have never found a good explanation in the literature. I don't think anyone really knows how. I'm sure there's probably some hand-wavy stuff out there, but again, I've never really seen a good explanation as to why. Okay, so if you see you're asking for a drug that raises hemoglobin F, think of hydroxyurea, which we used to treat sickle cell disease. Okay, now another hemoglobin I want to talk about is hemoglobin BART. Basically, if you see hemoglobin BART, a person clearly has alpha thalassemia, right? They have like the really nasty one where they literally have like all four genes gone. Because remember, for your alpha globin gene, you have four genes, right? If all four are messed up, you're not going to be born alive, basically. That's like that's the only kind of thalassemia where the child will die in utero. Hemoglobin BART, right? So what's hemoglobin BART? Hemoglobin BART is gamma 4. Well, how in the world do you get hemoglobin BART? Well, think about it. If you have alpha thal, you know, alpha thalassemia has like many different gradations, you know, because again, there are four genes that code for alpha globin. So if you mess up three or less, you're going to be born alive. But if you mess up all four, you're not going to be born alive because you literally don't have any alpha globin genes. If you have no alpha globin genes, that's going to be problematic. Literally, that's going to be problematic. Why? Because basically, fetal hemoglobin is alpha 2, gamma 2. Well, if you don't have alphas at all, then the gammas are going to be like, man, I don't see any alphas to get married to. So the gammas are going to all pair up together. They're all going to pair up together. And if the gammas all pair up together, you're going to have gamma 4. Gamma 4 is literally hemoglobin BART. That is not compatible with any kind of meaningful life. So those kids are going to die in utero. It's really sad. Really sad to say, but those kids are certainly gonna be dying in utero. Okay, now what's the next thing I want to talk about here? Let's talk about hemoglobin H. Hemoglobin H disease is something you find also in alpha thalassemia. We find it in people that have people that have alpha thalassemia and three of the genes don't work. Remember, I said if you have three or less of the genes affected, you'll be born alive. But if you have all four affected, you're not going to be born alive. Those kids are going to die in utero. Those kids are going to die in utero. those kids are going to die in Europe. They're going to die in Europe. So, but hemoglobin H disease is something we find when people have alpha thalassemia, and three of the genes are messed up, right? So basically, three are messed up and one is still functioning. So 75% of their genes are pretty much gone, but 25% work. But the thing is, again, these people have a very severe depletion in their alpha globin chains. They don't have enough alpha. So since they don't have enough alpha, but they've been born, well, if you're born, you need adult hemoglobin A, which is alpha 2 beta 2. But man, because they're like, gee, I don't have enough alphas, the betas are going to start pairing up with each other. The betas are going to start pairing up with each other. So they're going to have beta 4. Beta 4 is hemoglobin H. Many times people that have hemoglobin H disease, they tend to be very transfusion dependent. They tend to be very, very transfusion dependent. That's pretty high yield to know for exams. Now, I know some people may be like, Divine, can't hemoglobin A2 be increased in alpha thalassemia? The answer to that question is going to be no. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. You just have to literally understand the mechanism. Think about it. What is hemoglobin A2? I literally just said that hemoglobin A2 is alpha 2, delta 2. What globin chain does hemoglobin A2 seem to contain? Contains alpha and delta. Well, if you ain't got alphas, I don't know how you're going to be raising your hemoglobin A2, right? So, in fact, this question I posed explains why beta thalassemia can be diagnosed with hemoglobin electrophoresis, but alpha thalassemia cannot. Wait, what? Yeah, you heard me correctly. Beta thalassemia can be diagnosed with hemoglobin electrophoresis, but alpha thalassemia cannot. In fact, I will strongly encourage you on your USMLE exams, thou shalt not pick hemoglobin electrophoresis as the way you want to diagnose alpha thalassemia. Hemoglobin electrophoresis is largely going to be normal in a person that has alpha thalassemia. Why is that? Well, let me explain. The thing about alpha globin is that it's like a very pervasive kind of hemoglobin. We find it in almost every hemoglobin of note. We find it in adult hemoglobin, alpha 2 beta 2. We find it in hemoglobin A2, alpha 2 delta 2. We find it in hemoglobin F, alpha 2 gamma 2. Right? We find it in many hemoglobins. So the thing is, hemoglobin electrophoresis is like a test of relative difference, right? Like, oh, is this one more than the other? So because all these hemoglobins all contain alphas, they are all going to be proportionally decreased. So because they are all decreased roughly in the same proportion, you will not see any relative difference. But in beta thalassemia, you absolutely will see a relative difference. Because why? The thing is, there's only one major class of hemoglobin that has beta globin chains in it, right? Adult hemoglobin, alpha 2, beta 2, right? So you're going to notice that, if a person has beta thalassemia, the adult hemoglobin is going to be decreased, but the others are going to be increased, things like hemoglobin A2, right? You're going to see that relative difference. That's why we can use hemoglobin electrophoresis to diagnose beta thalassemia. Again, many resources don't talk about this point, but it's a very, very high yield point to know for the purposes of the USMLE exams. All right, now let's go ahead and continue. So what if they give you a question about a person that has a testicular mass, and then they tell you that the person's beta HCG is markedly elevated? What may you see? What mass should you be thinking about? Well, I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, sounds a lot like this person has a seminoma. Sounds a lot like this person has a seminoma, right? Remember, these beta HCG raising lesions are pretty high yield to know for the exams, right? So let's talk about, actually, just real quick review. What are the causes of an increased beta HCG on our friendly USMLE exams? Well, number one is going to be pregnancy, right? If a person is pregnant, your beta HCG is going to be pretty, pretty high. And remember, your beta HCG, I think it's kind of important to know this, kind of tops out, you know, around like 10-ish, or just a little above that in terms of weeks. It basically tops out after the first trimester. It's not supposed to keep rising after the first trimester, right? And usually it tops out at around, like, let's say 110. Just look up the exact number, but I think it's like 110, 120-ish thousand, roughly. Again, that's like a good ballpark figure to know for your exams, right? But if you start seeing beta HCGs, so again, the first cause is going to be pregnancy. But if you start seeing beta HCGs that are like insane and astronomical, you're like, man, this person's beta HCG is like 400 grand, 500,000, 600,000, 700,000. When you start seeing it going the multiples of hundreds of thousands, there are basically two things you need to think about on your exam, especially in a woman. Number one, you want to think about this woman having some kind of molar pregnancy. Molar pregnancy, right? Gestational trophoblastic disease. That's one thing that causes a very high beta HCG. Another thing that can cause a very high beta HCG is going to be a choriocarcinoma. Choriocarcinomas have beta HCG as their tumor marker, right? But again, if you're looking at elevated beta HCG in a guy, I want you to think of a seminoma. Seminomas tend to have elevated beta HCG. Okay, seminomas tend to have elevated beta HCG. Okay, so what if they give you a question about a 25-year-old female? They tell you that, you know, she delivered a healthy newborn through a crash cesarean section, you know, let's say 5 minutes ago. And then this person is now hemodynamically unstable, right? The person has a blood pressure of like 90 over 75, or let's say 90 over 70. The person's heart rate is 160 beats per minute. The person's temperature is, you know, 99.4, you know, degrees Fahrenheit. What should you be thinking about here? Well, this person probably has postpartum hemorrhage. Postpartum hemorrhage, postpartum hemorrhage, postpartum hemorrhage. So what in the world do we do for postpartum hemorrhage? Well, the thing is, what's the most common cause? The most common cause of postpartum hemorrhage is uterine acne. Your uterus literally has no tone, right? Usually we have this in many situations. Actually, it's kind of high yield to know the risk factors for uterine acne. Again, uterine acne just means your myometrium just is kind of cooped out. It's like, man, I can't contract anymore. Well, what can cause these things on exams? Number one, it can be if you're carrying just multiple kids. Let's say, for example, you're carrying twins or triplets or whatever. Basically, like, your uterus has had to work harder than the average uterus in the process of being pregnant. So it's almost like, man, it's used up all its energy in carrying all those kiddos. So when it's time to actually push them out, it's a problem. That's one. Second cause of this is if, for example, a person is, what's the other thing I'm thinking about here? If, for example, the person has had a very prolonged labor, so you've been pushing for a very, very, very long period of time, you know, again, your myometrium is a muscle. It's going to get tired, and that can cause a uterine acne. So when a person has uterine acne, which is the, you know, most common cause of postpartum hemorrhage, what's the first thing you're going to do? You're going to do a uterine massage. Basically, an OB-GYN doctor is going to stick her hand in your vagina and be compressing your uterus from the inside. And then she's going to be pressing on top of your pubic symphysis, you know, just above it, and also squishing your vagina. That's the first thing you're going to do, uterine massage. Uterine massage, they almost never put it as an answer on the USMLE. So let's go to what you do next. But really, that's the first thing you're supposed to do. You're supposed to do the uterine massage. Okay, what do you do number two? Well, number two, if uterine massage is not working, you're going to go to oxytocin. Or you're going to give the person Pitocin. It's going to contract down the uterus, contract down the myometrium, and that's going to be very, very helpful. And that can help the bleeding. And you may be like, Divine, how does that help bleeding? Well, think about it. Many of the blood vessels that we see in the uterus, they run in between the myometrium. So if you squish on the myometrium by compressing with oxytocin, then that's going to cause those blood vessels to be basically tied off. If they are tied off, then you're not going to bleed anymore, right? But if that does not work, you can begin to try other things like tranexamic acid. You can try tranexamic acid. Tranexamic acid is actually, you know, many people in the hospital, I think they call it TXA. It's something that's actually very, very helpful for reducing postpartum hemorrhage. Okay, very, very helpful for reducing postpartum hemorrhage. Basically, the way tranexamic acid works is that it's like lysine, and it has like anti-fibrinolytic properties. It basically prevents fibrinolysis. Remember, fibrinolysis has a strong association with bleeding. If you want to bleed, right, you want to start busting clots, but it basically prevents, is like the anti-clot buster, right? So it's pretty good for that purpose. We actually use it for a lot of things these days in medicine. But if you don't see that as an answer, you can begin to try exotic things like, you know, like misoprostol. Misoprostol can help you contract down the uterus as well, or you can use things like carboprost. Carboprost can also help you, you know, because it's a prostaglandin analog, it can help the uterus contract down. You'd be like, why will carboprost help? Well, let me explain something here. Prostaglandins can cause uterine contraction. Prostaglandins can cause uterine contraction. I mean, think about it. How do you think we treat primary dysmenorrhea? Well, remember, primary dysmenorrhea is when you have a painful period, painful menses. Well, why do you get all that pain? It's because your uterus is contracting violently. Your myometrium is contracting violently. So for primary dysmenorrhea, we're going to give an NSAID. An NSAID is a cyclooxygenase inhibitor. When you give a COX inhibitor, that's going to decrease our prostaglandin synthesis, and that's going to prevent the uterus from contracting like crazy, so it doesn't hurt. But in the case of postpartum hemorrhage, you want the uterus to contract down. So you're going to go ahead and give carboprost. If you give carboprost, it's a prostaglandin. It's going to contract down the uterus. It's going to be very, very helpful. Now, the one thing you want to keep in mind with prostaglandin is that prostaglandin is bronchospastic. So if you have a reactive airways, you know, like asthma, for example, Carboprost, maybe not the best idea in the world. You can also use ergotamine, but honestly, these days, people just try to not use that stuff because it just has quite a number of problems. It can jack up your blood pressure. Well, it's probably a good thing this person we have, that's pretty hypotensive, but it can jack up your blood pressure. And if there are so many contraindications, right? Let's say you have a history of strokes, can't really use it because it is a very powerful vasoconstrictor, right? So it's not good. It can give you strokes, or you have a history of MIs. Basically, if you're a person that has like very tenuous vessels, ergot agents are not maybe a particularly good idea. Okay, so let's go ahead and stop here. This has gone on for 20 minutes. I do offer review classes. I have a bunch of review classes for step one all the way to step three coming up in November. If you're interested, just shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. I offer one-on-one tutoring for step one all the way to step three, and you know, preclinical med school exams, 30 shelf exams. I have these podcasts on the major apps, Apple, Google, Spotify. And then I have another website, divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Basically, on that website, I post two podcasts every week that, you know, uses a biblical perspective to address a life lesson. So if you're interested in any of these, just shoot me an email. And I also have a podcast I made on my website, divineinterventionpodcast.com, where I actually have the dates. You know, you can listen to the podcast, but the dates are also in the commentary below the podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in episode 488. God bless you. Bye for now. Thank you.